State lawmakers have just 4 weeks to debate and vote on bills, including Governor Pritzker's biggest priority, changing our state's income tax system. The plan passed the Senate on Wednesday. Now it goes to the House. And as hate crimes against Muslims in Illinois and the rest of the country become more visible, a new report out today tracks the millions of dollars and thousands of groups fueling anti-Islamic hate in America.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour as Ramadan begins, we'll be talking about a new report out today tracking millions of dollars that are coming not just from fringe groups, but foundations to fuel anti-Muslim hate in this country. And the website TurboTax promised the IRS that lower income earners could file for free, but the company has kept users away from its free version on purpose. But first, we're entering crunch time in the State House. The Illinois General Assembly has 4 weeks to debate, vote on, and pass bills. In both his inaugural and budget addresses, Governor J.B. Pritzker laid out many big ticket items he wants the democratically controlled State House to send to his desk. The big news this weekend, Governor Pritzker has reached an agreement with key lawmakers on a plan to legalize recreational marijuana in Illinois starting next January. The proposed legislation would legalize recreational use of the drug for adults 21 and over. Purchase would have to come from licensed dispensaries, and an Illinois resident can possess up to about an ounce. The measure, which is set to be introduced in the State House this morning, would also automatically expunge some existing marijuana convictions. Medical cannabis, as a reminder, is already legal here, and we've been talking quite a bit about this, as many of our public radio stations have throughout the state. Visit 21stShow.org to see some of those conversations, including the State of Cannabis series that aired last week. There's one other item Governor Pritzker has made a hallmark of his first year, and that's changing the structure of our state income tax. And now that measure is also making its way through Springfield.
This tax plan does ask people who are wealthier to pay more, but not unreasonably so. And it does give a tax break to 97% of people across the state of Illinois.
There are a handful who believe that the answer to government's problems is simply to raise taxes.
There are clear policy objectives that they want to accomplish that we're just simply not going to agree on, the graduated income tax being one of those.
There are people here I know who disagree with me, and that's healthy in our democracy. But to be clear, doing nothing is not an option.
You heard Governor J.B. Pritzker there at the beginning and end of that, along with Republican State Senator Dale Ryder and the Illinois Retail Merchants Association President Rob Carr. Ultimately, to change our income tax, our state's constitution will need to be changed. But for now, Governor Pritzker and his supporters have cleared the first of many hurdles to get this plan through the state Senate. For that and more, I'm joined by Amanda Vinicky, a correspondent with WTTW Chicago Tonight. Peter Hancock is also with us, a State House reporter for Capital News Illinois. Amanda, Peter, good morning. Welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning. Thanks.
Amanda, so in Governor Pritzker's first year, we've talked about how he's talked about this in his inauguration and in his first budget address. Now we're at the first home stretch of the legislative session. And can you just remind us how much time he and lawmakers have now to pass all of these bills we've been talking about?
They have quite the heavy load ahead of them, really, for the remainder of this month. Session is set to adjourn May 31st. That's not really the drop-dead deadline, given that technically the new budget doesn't start until July 1st with the graduated income tax. There certainly is plenty of time, because even if it does get past the legislature and onto a ballot, that won't be until November of 2020. So technically there's a whole lot of time, but certainly the expectation is that everything be wrapped up by May 31st. First of all, there's just changes in terms of how many votes are needed to pass legislation after that point in time if they're to have immediate effect. But by and large, it's a PR thing. Governor Pritzker came in doing his darndest to be as different from his predecessor, Governor Bruce Rauner, as possible. Of course, Illinois is on the heels and still really suffering from the consequences of not having a budget for that historic time and that prolonged impasse. Pritzker promised bipartisanship, and he wants all of these measures done and taken care of before that scheduled adjournment deadline of May 31st.
Peter, that said, what's the mood like in the State House right now?
Well, right at the moment, they're home for an extended weekend. But I think you're starting to sense the pressure is building. And, you know, people have been waiting for the marijuana legislation to come forward for a long time. We thought we were going to see it earlier last week. Didn't see that until Saturday. And so there is a growing sense that the clock is ticking and stuff needs to start moving fairly quickly.
Okay. We are going to talk about the graduated income tax. We've heard lots of different ways to refer to this. We, as always, those of you listening, if you have questions or comments, we would love to hear from you on this. Is this something you support? Do you have questions about how this would all work out? We're going to be talking to Peter and Amanda about this. But if you want to join us via text, you can text your questions or comments to 217-394-5765. Save that number in your phone. That's how you can always get in touch with us. Again, you can text questions to 217-394-5765. Please include your first name and your hometown, if you don't mind. So, Amanda, just to get back to what you were saying about Governor Pritzker and striking a different tone than Governor Rauner, how much of this is about him when we're looking at this is something he's made really a signature? He campaigned on this tax. How important is his role in this in conversations with persuading lawmakers to go along with this?
Oh, his role in this is huge. This isn't the first time that we've heard about a graduated income tax. Certainly, there have been certain organizations and legislators that have been wanting this to go for years. It's a notion that Governor Pat Quinn backed, but really wasn't able to get much movement on. I think part of this is a moment. Again, Democrats are still fairly galvanized after the Rauner years at sticking together. You cannot dismiss Pritzker money. I mean, he spent his, $170 million to get elected in that last election. We don't know how much money he is spending now with the graduated income tax because there's dark money groups on both sides, and therefore we aren't privy to that information, those disclosures. Though the one that Pritzker has admitted he is putting money into has said that eventually it will share what sort of contributions it got. But they're airing commercials. That costs a heck of a lot of money, and this is really just starting. So it's both, you know, Pritzker getting Democrats on board. I think also Democrats really wanting to generally stick together, and the fact that J.B. Pritzker, by virtue of his personal fortune, isn't just using the mouthpiece and, you know, the forum that comes with being governor. He can really back up his talk with an entire campaign apparatus. And we are most certainly going to see that. We already have. But again, it is just going to ramp up from here. It is huge. And I will also add that he's really made this sort of a test of his abilities as governor. He campaigned.
Hey, Amanda, it looks like we lost you there for a second. We're going to try to reconnect if you hold on. We've been talking to Amanda Vinicky. She's a correspondent with WTTW Chicago Tonight. Peter Hancock is also with us from Capital News, Illinois. Peter, Amanda was talking about all of the dark money, the campaigns, people are getting flyers. Let's just talk about what we actually know now. And I feel like I should say for those of you listening, these are two journalists who are following this, who have been doing this. They are independent. They are not swayed by either side. Like lots of the information. There's a lot of misinformation out there. So let's just talk about what the Senate passed this week. What actually passed on Wednesday? The vote was 40-19 along party lines, Peter. What happened on Wednesday?
On Wednesday, the Senate passed the proposed constitutional amendment. Now, all that really does, though, is give the General Assembly authority to levy a multi-tiered, multi-bracket, or graduated income tax structure. Mm-hmm. There was also a package of trailer legislation, and these are bills that say, in the event that the constitutional amendment takes effect, here's where the rates would be for different income categories. There was also a bill that provides some additional property tax relief, saying that if the state meets its obligation to fully fund K through 12 education, then school districts could not raise their property taxes for that year. And then there was a very controversial piece that came along, and I'm not entirely sure where it came from, and I haven't talked to anybody else, but it says in the event that these higher rates go into effect, or the amendment goes into effect, Illinois would also phase out or eliminate its current estate tax. And it looked like maybe that was something that, like throwing a bone to the Republicans. If that was their intention, it clearly didn't work.
Peter, I think this is a really good, I think, case study in how the political sausage gets made, right? Because it's kind of like, Amanda, I wonder if you can kind of chime in here. Like, I mean, certainly J.B. Pritzker did not go out and campaign on, if I am passing a fair tax, I will also eliminate the estate tax and freeze school district property tax rates. But Amanda, can you explain a little bit more about the other two companion bills here and how much this is about compromise or trying to get other people on board?
I'm not sure how much it's about actually trying to get other people on board, because Republicans have been very clear that they are no, that they are against this notion, and there, I think, will be little that will change their minds. Pritzker has, it's a smart strategy and likely true, a lot of the most high-income earners in Illinois are going to be based in Chicago and the surrounding regions. Not that you don't have any in outlying areas throughout the rest of the state, but by and large, the people that are going to be paying the bulk of the money that will bring in this revenue via the graduated income tax are going to be located in areas that aren't represented by Republican legislators. So again, Pritzker, when he talks about it, wisely, I think, from a political point of view, says, I don't understand why Republicans would be against it, because it will mean lower taxes for their own residents and constituents. In terms of these other bills, I think that's also it. Sure, it might be trying to get Republicans on board. By and large, I think it is also preparing for the next election. Again, once and if this does pass the General Assembly, it will be on the ballot. This will be central to legislative races in 2020. And so for Democrats to be able to say, I passed a measure that they will characterize it as bring your taxes down, hold a line on your property taxes. Those who are making a play in areas where there are estate taxes, throwing a bone to the people who are the people with income over $1 million and therefore going to be passing down a large estate that would be taxed. So it's also, I think, trying to pacify, farmers, Republicans, high-income earners. There's a whole bunch of people. They're going to do anything and everything they can to make this as palatable as possible.
Amanda, how much of this also is about whether these bills are good for our state's finances? What do we know about if we're thinking about, so we're thinking about changing the graduated income tax rate, eliminating an estate tax, freezing school district property tax rates. What do we know about how this affects the state's finances right now?
Well, that's sort of the great wide unknown. We have gotten figures certainly from the Pritzker administration in terms of the revenues they expect to bring in. And again, as you played at the top there, the governor saying we have no choice, we must do something. This is clearly that prescription. Every time that you make a change like this, it will have unforeseen consequences. What does it mean for school districts if they can't tax more locally? That's going to be because they will be getting the guaranteed amount of money from the state. But you're right. What does that mean for state finances? Part of the revenue that is supposed to come in from the graduated income tax already promised to go to pensions. We've seen the unveiling of the marijuana bill, as you noted. A lot of the revenues for that are already allocated to particular areas. So really, what does this mean? Yes, if it were to happen, the calculation is certainly that it would bring Illinois more money. But there's a whole lot of ifs. There's also the expectation that perhaps who knows what happens with the economy. If it goes belly up, will there be fewer people making over $1 million that will be paying that highest tax rate? Or perhaps will some of them move? So right now it is, I think, really too early, and we haven't seen the numbers behind the projections. But I think there are a few that would argue with the governor's assessment that something has to be done. Whether this is it, the right course, that I think is obviously a question that as journalists, we don't have the answer to, but a question that I certainly will continue to ask, because it is true that Illinois' budget at this point in time is on an unsustainable path, no matter what side of the aisle you are on.
Peter Hancock is also with us. He's with Capital News Illinois. Peter, do we know what's being proposed? I mean, we've heard that this would be a progressive tax. We know that. Do we know what the can you just remind us of what this would look like in terms of percentages?
Okay, so if you earn less than, I have all of the cutoff lines memorized.
Yeah, we're almost we're almost to a break. So if you just want to do broad, and then we can get into more of the details after.
If you earn like $30,000 a year or less, you pay, let's say, 4.9% on that $30,000. If your income goes up to $60,000, then you pay a slightly higher rate on that amount above $30,000. And so there are like four tax brackets. And then you get to, and I'm just talking about individuals here, not married couples. Governor Pritzker had proposed $1 million. The legislation actually says $750,000. Then you pay virtually 8% tax on all of the income from $1 up to $750,000 or above.
Okay. So let me stop you there, Peter, because we have to take a break, but we can get into some of the details of this. By the way, if you have questions, you can text us at 217-394-5765, and we'll pick up this conversation on the other side of this break.
Support comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting From Hand to Hand, Painting and the Animation of History in Northern India, on view now through May 12th. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
The 21st. I'm Myla Boodoo. My guests are Peter Hancock, State House reporter for Capital News Illinois, and Amanda Vinicky with WTTW Chicago Tonight. The legislative session ends on May 31st, and there's a lot going on in the State House, including, as we've been discussing, the governor's plan to overhaul our state's income tax system. Peter, I wonder, just before the break, I don't think you had a chance to finish that thought, just looking at broad strokes of what's being proposed here. Basically, you're saying that what was passed in the House on Wednesday was for an income level of $750,000 or more. That would really be where we start seeing maybe an 8% tax rate structure that continues. Does it go higher than 8%?
No, it's like 7.99%, and that applies. That's the highest tax bracket. So anything above $750,000 for an individual or $1 million for a couple filing jointly would be taxed at that rate, and all of their income would be taxed at that rate. Other people, you only pay incrementally higher rates on incrementally higher amounts of money. So all told, this is supposed to bring in around $3.5 billion a year in additional revenue. The governor has said that the budget as it stands now is about $3.2 billion out of balance. So that's what they're looking at. A lot of the money... portion of the money would be earmarked for paying down pension debt, paying down some past due bills, and then, you know, mostly to the general fund.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to play some audio just to show what the debate looked like in the Senate. And here's the sponsor of the bill, Democratic Senator Don Harmon. He represents Illinois' 39th district, which includes the Chicago suburbs of Oak Park and Bensonville. Let's take a listen to him.
If you're saying the flat tax is a good idea, you are protecting the uber rich, not the middle class. Because we can't raise taxes on anyone without raising taxes on everyone. And that's a protection for the richest among us.
That's State Senator Don Harmon. Peter, I imagine the Democrats are trying to reduce all of this discussion to that, which is if you're protecting this, you're protecting rich people.
Yeah, there is kind of a class warfare tinge to this whole thing. But I think Senator Harman makes a point, and the Republicans are making the same point. The reason that provision is in the current Constitution is to make it difficult to raise taxes. You can't raise taxes on one group of people without raising taxes on everybody, and that makes tax increases politically very difficult. And the Democrats will tell you that tax increases are always going to be politically difficult, and it's not going to become any easier under this plan. But the other thing is, by making it difficult for the state to generate new money, you also make it incredibly difficult for the state to keep up with the rising cost of providing the services that it provides, including healthcare services, where the costs are spiraling out of control, some would say.
Let's hear a little bit about what Republicans are saying about this. Here's State Senator Chapin Rose from the 51st Senate District, which includes parts of East Central Illinois, including Champaign, DeWitt, and McLean counties. Senator Chapin Rose.
Look what these Democrats have done. They don't even attempt to cut any spending before asking the taxpayers for more money. Not even an attempt. Not even a penny. I mean, where are the cuts, you know, before you ask people to pony up more? You know, that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, this whole notion of, you know, is the, 97% of the people are going to get tax cuts. Really? Does anybody really believe that?
That's Senator Chapin Rose. Amanda, this is what Republicans have been saying, that even though the Democrats' income tax plan doesn't raise taxes if you're lower or middle income, the public shouldn't trust Democrats on this. Do we know whether that's accurate?
I think that there's always going to be a natural tension, of course, between the parties. And Republicans would say that Democrats have not done their due diligence in just what you heard Senator Rose say right there, in showing that they have gone through and really taken a good hard look at the budget and where the dollars are spent, if they're spent well or not, before making this ask. Democrats would point back and say, hey, look, we just went through 4 years under Governor Bruce Rauner, and with the impasse between he and Democrats who were in charge of the General Assembly, that everything in government really fell down, and that caused not only a backlog of bills, but that Illinois needs to reinvest in programs, be it healthcare, universities, education, and so on, after going through such a troubled time. In terms of how easy it will be, it gets, I think, to Peter's point that you might see it, because the public appears to like, yes, tax the rich, go for it. That's where the business community very much fears that without the restraint, that you could see legislators be more apt to raise taxes on certain parts of the population while not on others. So, again, this is all certainly new ground for Illinois to be breaking. And I think it's probably too early for us to really venture and play out any of those scenarios.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I'm sorry, I forgot to source where we got that audio with Senator Chapin Rose from his office, from Senate Republicans. Amanda, can I just ask you one last question about you being, I know you've been in state politics, you've been around this for a while, and I wonder what you think how the mood is with lawmakers in terms of how important they think this debate is, what the kind of the tone of the conversation compared to things past?
It is huge. And what is different than in the past is really how long this has been out there and how long it will be out there. When I've been covering tax increases, you see them introduced, and the next minute they're voted on. There isn't a whole lot of time for the public or legislators to really digest them, and that helps them to pass. In this regard, we saw asked Governor Pritzker about it all throughout the campaign. And while it was frustrating to not get any sort of tax rates or details all throughout that, he did introduce his vision pretty early on upon after getting sworn into office and becoming the governor. So it's really been out there for a while. And as I said earlier, it's going to continue to be out there. So that certainly changes the dynamic at play politically and also the conversation. But this is huge. It would have huge and lasting consequences, and it is huge also for Governor Pritzker's legacy. If for whatever reason he isn't able to get this through the General Assembly by the end of May, it's almost like the next 3 years he will be lame duck already.
Wow. Those are big stakes, people, Amanda.
It's a big prediction. It's huge. If he's not able to do it, he has staked so much on this. It would be huge. And that is, particularly given that there are super, super majorities of Democrats, and he's a Democratic governor. So I think while there is an unease and everybody is hesitant, I'm certainly hesitant to always predict how things will play out. May is a very busy time, and there are so many extra measures that could be worked into this, a capital bill. Will that be used as a sweetener, or does it make it harder for legislators to stomach passing a tax like this? Because if you're going to pay for a monster infrastructure bill, you'll also need to pass new revenues to pay for that. So that's a whole lot of reaching into people's pockets. But again, maybe that helps because they can bring something home to their districts. So I'm not in the business of predicting what legislators will do, but it is certainly monumental and huge for Governor Pritzker and his first year in office, and therefore the rest of the term, because he did campaign on it and he has staked so much on it.
That's WTTW Chicago Tonight's Amanda Vinicky. Peter, real quick, we're almost out of time. Now this goes to the House?
Now it goes to the House, and I think there you're going to see Republicans put up even more of a fight to the extent that they're able. But kind of building on something that Amanda was saying, this is all going to be about the 2020 elections. And Republicans suffered some pretty significant losses in the 2018 elections. They're now in a super minority in both chambers. They're looking to win back some seats. And this, I think, is the issue where they can draw the biggest contrast between their party and the Democratic Party, particularly in the collar counties around Chicago, where they lost seats in traditionally Republican areas. I think you're going to see them really working hard to build up opposition in that part of the state in hopes of trying to win back some of their seats in 2020.
That's Peter Hancock with Capital News Illinois. Peter, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Tax day was a few weeks ago. You probably have even forgotten how you do your taxes. People do it lots of different ways, with accountants, by hand. But the most common out there is using tax prep sites like TurboTax. TurboTax and companies like it promise the IRS that people making $66,000 a year or less can file for free. But as it turns out, these companies have made it extremely difficult to actually find and use the free version of its services, which means that many lower income Americans have been paying for something they're entitled to use for free. According to reporting by ProPublica, this isn't a bug. This is a feature that companies are deliberately steering customers towards. And for more on this, I'm joined by Justin Elliott, who's been reporting on this issue. He's on the line from New York. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the 21st.
Hey, good to be here.
So the latest story you have, Justin, shows that this isn't a bug. And in fact, there were actually attempts by one company in particular with H&R Block to deliberately hide a free option.
Yeah, that's right. So these companies, they have an agreement with the IRS that says they're going to offer a free option to many Americans, especially lower income Americans. And we recently obtained and published this sort of internal guidance to H&R Block staff that actually says explicitly, don't tell customers about this free file option because we want to steer them to our paid option. So it doesn't really get more clear than that.
And why does this agreement exist in the first place? Because some people might say, why are these for-profit companies offering a free option for low-income Americans?
Yeah, there's sort of an interesting history to it. So first of all, in many other countries around the world, you don't even really have to do your taxes because the tax agency already has your data, just like the IRS does. If you have a normal job, you just get a pre-filled out form that you glance over and sort of click OK. Obviously, in this country, we don't have that. And the nature of this deal, this free file deal between the industry and the IRS, is that there's sort of two parts to it. The first part, and this is what's really valuable to the companies, is that the IRS, as part of the deal, promises not to create its own free system, which would be dangerous competition to the companies. And in exchange for that promise, the companies say, we will offer a free option, especially to lower income people. So that's sort of the history here.
And so you have your most recent reporting on this has internal memos from H&R Block. I think a lot of people are familiar with TurboTax. That's actually owned by a company called Intuit. Did they have similar practices?
We definitely found some evidence of that. So, I mean, one of the sort of striking things about the free file program is that even though actually most of the country, 70% of all taxpayers are technically eligible for it, we found that only actually under 2% of those eligible find it and use it, and most other people end up paying the companies. One of the reasons for that we found is that the companies have actually hidden their free file websites from search engines like Google. They put some code in there that basically tells Google, don't include this in your search results. And so I think that pretty clearly speaks to the intent, and we found that with TurboTax as well as H&R Block.
Wow. So who is supposed to be eligible?
So the program as a whole, it's anyone who makes under $66,000, which again turns out to be 70% of the country. And then each company within that has its own sort of special eligibility requirements. So for TurboTax, it's actually lower. It's making under $34,000, but that's still 20 or 30% of the country.
And so you actually heard from a lot of readers who are affected by this, right? People who should have been able to file for free, but wound up paying for TurboTax. What did they tell you about how much this affected their finances? Obviously, these are the people who can least afford to do this, right?
Yeah, my email box is full and my phone's ringing, getting calls from people who make $15,000, $20,000 a year and ended up being directed by TurboTax mainly into the paid version. And people paid anywhere from $50 to as high as $200. And, you know, $200 for somebody that makes $15,000 a year, that's more than 1% of your entire year's income. So it's real money, and people have been upset about it. Some people have been calling back and have gotten refunds from the company, but it's not clear whether that's an official policy and they won't answer my questions about it.
TurboTax and H&R Block won't answer questions about whether or not they're going to give people back their money?
Well, I've mainly been focused on TurboTax, which is by far the biggest player in this market. That's where some people have gotten refunds, and we put up a whole post, the phone number and everything, telling people how they can try to do this. Some people have been successful. Other people say that they're now saying no. And yeah, the company has not been answering my repeated questions about what the policy is.
And what have they said about what they've done? What have they said?
You know, I mean, one of the striking things is after we wrote our story showing that they had put this code on their truly free website so that it wouldn't appear on Google, they changed it. They removed that snippet of code. So now you can find it on Google. But of course, this happened after April 15th. So it was too
right.
late for
everybody's
a lot of people.
Filed taxes almost. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, other than that, they've issued pretty broad statements saying that they support this program. And, you know, again, sort of the paradox of this program is that the companies have supported it, but not because they have to offer this free option, rather because the program also ties the IRS's hands. And these companies' business models would be severely damaged, if not destroyed, if the IRS itself had an easier, better filing system.
So what has the IRS said about this, Justin?
Yeah, I mean, so the other story here is that this has really been a failure of oversight by the IRS. Turns out there's only three people in the entire IRS that have any oversight of this program, and they were criticized last year by an IRS expert counsel, which said that there didn't seem to be much, if any, oversight of the program going on. So the IRS so far has stood by it and said they believe it's a successful program that's helped a lot of people over the years, and we haven't really been able to get much more out of them at this point, which is pretty typical for that agency. They tend to be kind of closed-mouthed.
Well, I know you will continue to report on this story. We will tweet out Justin's reporting he's done on this for ProPublica. If you want to read more about this, follow this issue. Justin Elliott, based in New York for ProPublica, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Muslims around the world and right here in Illinois are beginning to celebrate their holy month of Ramadan. Unfortunately, here in Illinois, this holiest of times has been marred by an attack against one suburban Chicago family's home. It comes also as CARE, the country's largest Muslim civil rights organization, releases a report that tracks millions of dollars fueling extreme anti-Muslim hate movements. And that money isn't just coming from fringe groups, but from mainstream foundations. Ahmed Rehab is the executive director of the Chicago chapter of CARE, and he's on the line now from there. Hi, Ahmed. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I wonder if we can start with the unfortunate incident that took place last weekend in the Chicago suburbs of Bolingbrook. What happened?
Well, basically, we received a call from a community member that his home had been attacked. His family's home had been attacked in the wee hours of the morning last Saturday. Actually, the Saturday before last Saturday. Family was sleeping in the rooms, and a big brick went through the window of the son's bedroom, shattering the glass and landing inside, luckily not injuring him, he's 21 years old, but really startling him. So the father went out to look around, and what he found was just as startling. Basically, hate graffiti all over the house that included the B word, the F word, you know, homophobic slurs and you know, anti-black slurs, but also misogynistic and Islamophobic graffiti. Arab was plastered on the wall, graffiti, and as well as a swastika. A couple of swastikas were on there as well. So the family was really alarmed. They've lived in the house for 5 years, in the neighborhood for longer, never had any issues before. This is close to Naperville, one of the, if not the most celebrated neighborhood in America as a place to raise a child, to raise a family, the number one suburb in America. So it's not in Naperville, it's in Bolingbrook, which is very close, but still. So basically, you know, this, they're thinking to themselves, where can we be safe? You know, mosques are attacked. People are attacked on the streets, and here we are at home.
Yeah, I mean, I was a bit surprised to read in the Sun-Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, that the Bolingbrook police told the Sun-Times, quote, there is no indication this attack was directed due to religious affiliation. That's Bolingbrook Police Lieutenant Anthony Columbus said in an email to the Chicago Sun-Times. He said, we have no evidence a, quote, white supremacist conducted the vandalism. I do understand that police are now investigating this as a hate crime, but I wonder what your response is to what the lieutenant said.
We responded to the lieutenant directly and through the media by saying to him and to the police department that we seem to have a bit of a different understanding of hate crimes. I think for them, if this were a person that knew a member of the family and therefore it was targeted rather than random or sporadic, then for them it wasn't a hate crime. For us, it was very clear per the statutes that we pulled up from the laws of this, of the state and then the city and the federal laws, that actually, regardless of whether this was a targeted or a random attack, the fact that it was violent coupled with racial epithets makes it a hate crime automatically. So I think they adjusted based on that.
As we think about entering Ramadan, I wonder how much you're concerned about security in American mosques as we think about this holy month.
We're very concerned. I mean, sadly, what happened in New Zealand has caused reverberations across the world, especially in the West. And much as it is something that hopefully is rare, it is difficult for anybody to walk in through their mosque doors and not at least visualize something potentially happening at some point. It's just such a vulnerable situation. You know, you're there, your back's are to the doors, and you're prostrating downwards. And, so it's a highly vulnerable situation. It's very important that our mosques up their security, and CARE has been working with them and sending them information and really urging everyone to not panic and not, you know, change their lifestyle or anything like that, but to take precautions to make sure their communities are safe.
And when we're thinking about safety and security, I wanted to ask you about a report that CARE nationally, you're of course executive director of the Chicago chapter, but the national organization released a report today quantifying money behind different anti-Muslim hate groups, We're talking about millions of dollars that are flowing into something you guys are calling the Islamophobia Network. Can you explain what that is?
There are, when you talk about Islamophobia, you could talk about individuals who consume narratives against Muslims and just sort of lash out, you know, driving down the road or seeing a Muslim in a mall or something. Or you could be talking about a more engineered sort of form of Islamophobia where agenda-driven groups and individuals who believe that it is in their interest or in the interest of their politics to render Muslims a scary thing, the boogeyman, a threat to society in order for Muslims not to advance, then begin to push out these false narratives through blogs, through websites, through emails, through memes, through social media viral posts, even through documentaries, books, and articles. And we've identified some of these groups, and we've identified how much money has been poured into this Islamophobia network, the one that is engineering hatred against Muslims and Islam, in the last two years, between 2014 and 2016. And it was to the tune of $1.5
billion. So repeat that again. Ahmed, you're saying $1.5 billion has been.
Billion
and is this just in the U.S. or is this around the world?
This was in the U.S., yeah.
So you're saying there are groups that have spent $1.5 million in the U.S. to sort of spread this agenda, $1.5 billion.
Over a period of 2 years, yeah. And, you know, there are different motivations, but the two main ones tend to come from the far-right evangelical communities that see Islam as a threat religiously.
Evangelical Christian communities, to be clear.
Correct. Mm-hmm. They see Islam as a threat in the sense that it's the only other religion that proselytizes and that is people convert to at high rates. So they see that as a threat to their own efforts to proselytize and save people through Jesus and that type of thing. And then the other main sort of ideological camp is the one that we can term far-right Zionist, which renders Muslims a threat to their national project of Israel, basically not being questioned, receiving as much funding from the United States as possible, and not being criticized when it, you know, engages in apartheid or occupation or military campaigns against civilians like the ones that are happening right now. And Muslims tend to be some of the most vociferous critics of those illegal actions. And so by trying to demonize Muslims, hopefully get their voices erased is the idea there for them. So they pour in a lot of money to sort of suggest that all Muslims who are relevant are terrorists or tied to terrorism or secret supporters of terrorism, so that when they do speak out, nobody listens. So these are the two main sort of camps, ideological camps, but there are others as well.
Where did you all get, how did you guys come up with that number and how did you track this?
Oh, it's a lot of work went into this. The methodology is difficult to explain over an interview of a few minutes, but there are other efforts that have been around that we were able to cull from, including organizations that monitor hate. There are filings of not-for-profits that are public that one can view. And then you sort of look at the sources of funding together with the products that come out from these not-for-profits, so-called not-for-profits. And you can see that it's Islamophobic or hate material, and you see the money that is coming in behind it, and you can match things together. That's just one of the ways in which this was called, yeah.
So what do you want people to know about this?
That sadly, while Islamophobia, some of it is knee-jerk, just like racism or homophobia, a lot of it in this modern world in the West, in this modern era in the West, is actually engineered by people who know what they're doing, by people who purposely befuddle facts. It's not different from, you know, the Russian efforts to hurt American democracy by putting out false information, rumors. For example, the instance in which I think there was a bombing on a bridge in London, and there was a young woman who wears a hijab who was on the cell phone, and they sort of published that picture to suggest that she was just there talking to a friend, passing over dead bodies, where in reality she was frantic and crying and and everything else. So they'll take a moment in time like that and spin it differently to paint a picture about Muslims that is very negative, and then kind of cause it to go viral. And hopefully, in their mind, not in my mind, obviously, but in their mind, hopefully, you know, these little droplets add up to a bucket, and the buckets add up to an ocean, you know, as they do more and more of these. So that's why you get today these narratives of Muslims being violent, or their religion promotes violence, or that they want to kill infidels, quote-unquote, and things that Muslims don't really believe in and don't support are being attributed to them through these efforts that these individuals and these groups are putting out there time and time again, obviously assisted with the very small, minute number of Muslims who are in fact terrorists, who are in fact violent. And so that's all they need, is to point to these people and then say everybody's like that, everybody supports that, which of course is the big lie in this.
Can I ask you, I was watching the news conference, the national news conference from D.C. this morning. One of the things one of the speakers talked about is how much these groups are tied to our current President Trump. What do you think is the link here?
A lot of these same people who fund these groups are funders of campaigns of President Trump and supporters publicly of President Trump. Sadly, I mentioned the evangelical and I mentioned the Zionists, but one of the big emerging camps of hate, not just against Muslims, but against Jews and blacks and Latinos and homosexuals and others, is the white supremacist camps. And, you know, it's a loaded term. It can range from people who are proud to associate with white supremacy through the garb and through the paraphernalia, things like the KKK, but it also includes more subtle forms that are not so blatant as to publicly support that stuff, but that nonetheless believe that, you know, white America is America, and that's the one that needs to be sustained, and that's the one that needs to be brought back. And that's essentially what they mean by make America great again, is make it white again, make it back where it was mostly people from European backgrounds before, you know, the brown migrations ruined it and brought it down. And the fear there for them is that this is going to continue to rise, and data does suggest that America will become majority Latino at some point. And so, you know, these groups who support Trump and who support his wall and who support his anti-immigration policies, they all come from the same ideological perspective. And ours is very simple. Ours is, it's not about race. It's not about religion. It's about merit. It's about hard work. It's about values. And that should, that, you know, the good values are good values, you know, vices are vices, regardless of what religion or race you come from. So we are they're focusing on the wrong thing here. And that's sort of where the fight is.
Yeah, Ahmed, we're almost out of time. I just wanted to ask you one last question. Is that we're talking about this at the beginning of Ramadan, and I can't help but think of other conversations I've had with people from other faith communities, whether we've talked about Yom Kippur or Good Friday, and how current events have changed their religious reflections during this time. And I wonder, for you personally, how the past few years have affected the way you think and approach this time of year.
Well, on one hand, on the positive side, it's caused us, and we try to eke out positive lessons as much, you know, even from the most negative, darkest situations. And one positive that we try to eke out of this is the fact that we're not in this alone, and the source of evil may vary, but at the end of the day, it is at the level of human nature. It's not at the level of religion. It's not that Jews can be evil, or Muslims can be evil, or Christians can be evil, nor is it that they can be good. I mean, goodness and evil is at the level of humans, right? Individual humans. So one person can be evil or good, and even then, they're not just evil or just good. They're committing an evil act or committing a good act. And so, this, you know, to us, the hope is we can limit evil by working on changing hearts, by working on healing minds and hearts with knowledge, with love, with compassion, so that the person who is committing acts of hatred or acts of evil can change and start to commit acts of love and acts of good. And as that happens, then hopefully bigger change occurs, because we're in this together. The attacks that happen against synagogues, they happen against me as a Muslim. That's the way I see it. And when they happen against me, my Jewish friends will say the same thing, that it happens against them. Likewise with blacks or Latinos or Asians or anybody else who's affected. So this is sort of how it's changed, is for me to start to think harder and deeper about how we're just part of a single unit, and that is human unit.
Thanks for that. Ramadan Mubarak, thank you for taking the time to join us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having this conversation with me. I appreciate it.
That does it for us today. You can always head to 21stshow.org for more information about our program, past shows, send us feedback. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.